Members, we don't have a quorum yet, but we're going to get started. We've got some time constraints today, so Representative Marquardt, welcome, and if you wanted to start explaining 2894.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 2894 involves watershed districts, and what it does is it raises the amount for watershed districts to have basically on loan or to borrow up to from $600,000, which is the current limit, to $2 million. Now, there is an amendment that will be added, and Representative Hansen was going to offer that, that would say that if the watershed district was under $500 million taxable market value, they could still only go to $600,000. So the $2 million limit would only apply to those watershed districts over the $500 million. So the seven smallest water districts in the state would not have that capacity. And that was some comfort language with Representative Hansen and I believe the Madam Chair. So, and I do have Ron Harnick here, who's the project manager for the Red River Water Management Board, and Ray Bone from the watershed districts are here also. But the fact that they do a lot of impoundments, that's one of the main things that watershed districts do, is water impoundments to help lessen the impact downstream on water. And when they do this, they have to acquire a large amount of land, and that $600,000 with the amount of land just doesn't work very well. So raising it $2 million will allow these impoundment projects to move forward in a more aggressive and in a quicker fashion. That's my bill, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Harnack, did you want to comment on any of this at this time?
Mr. Chairman, unless there's any questions that I can answer, Representative Marquardt did a fine job.
I guess we're at a stalemate here. We don't have a quorum, so sounds like your bill's going to fly, but
I don't think they can move.
Okay. I guess
we'll just
have to. Mr. Chair. Yeah. Thank you. Representative
McNamara. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Marquardt, or Mr. Harnack, how many watershed districts are looking to increase? Are you aware of any that are in a position today? The Red River evidently is interested.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the Red River watershed districts are the ones that would be primarily using this. Our impoundments vary between about 500 acres to 2,000 acres, and land values in the last number of years have gone from about $900 an acre to over $3,000 an acre. And we have to be able to get the land when landowners are interested in selling it, because if you don't take advantage of it at that time frame, somebody else is going to buy it. And we don't have other money available to help them acquire that land up front. So this borrowing authority will accelerate their capacity to purchase the land, and then ultimately the payback on that borrowing does not come through increased taxes. It comes through their existing levies and then through state grants that will come through the system when the project is ready to be constructed.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So what happens if a local watershed runs into financial trouble and isn't able to make the payments? Is the state liable at all, or do we stand behind that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, the state is not liable under those circumstances. I don't know of any that has gone into financial problems. Over the years, there's been, I think, two watershed districts that have been dissolved. Very, very small ones that basically had no purpose in continuing, and then the Board of Water and Soil Resources dissolved them.
But what would happen if they did go in default? Who are they actually borrowing this money from?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the majority of them are borrowing them from financial institutions. They can also borrow from the county, but in the instances where we've had borrowing that's already been done, it's been from a financial institution. Financial institution takes the land as collateral, and usually it's like 60 to 70 cents on the dollar. You know, so certainly the institution is protected from that standpoint.
And one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is this a situation where the watershed owns the land? It's not an easement situation, so they're able to put up the fee title interest in the land as their collateral?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Scalzi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for you, Mr. Harnack, or actually Representative Marquardt. Are there other areas where there are not watershed districts that are contributing to the problem that maybe aren't paying their fair share that might help you so that some watershed districts don't have to bear the full burden?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, I think I'd like Mr. Harnack to answer that. I mean, there is a map that some of you might have seen where there are areas that are not covered by watershed districts, but I can't answer whether or not that's paying for other areas.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the only area that I can really speak to is the Red River Valley. We also have a joint powers of watershed districts in the Red River Valley that helps share the cost for implementing these projects, because kind of everybody in the basin contributes to the flooding, so everybody should pay a bit in terms of resolving it. We don't have every area in the Red River Valley that's part of that and contributing. We're hoping over the next few years that we will have everybody in that system, and then everybody can share. It's kind of a, I don't know whether you want to call it, spreading the capacity to pay, because not every watershed district impoundment will benefit the Red River equally, you know. So some areas that have to put in more should be able to get money from the rest of the basin to help make that happen, because everybody benefits from it.
And as a follow-up, it would appear, or it just would seem to me, not knowing the area, I know some about it, but that the ones upstream who maybe don't get the most direct benefit as those downstream, you would think that they should be sharing because they're the ones who contribute. So it could be called a benefit to as well, because they're contributors, and unless everyone is putting money into the pot, it would seem that some people may be contributing twice, or maybe even three times through their watershed district or their Red River Watershed Management Board, and then maybe as a Minnesota taxpayer through Bowser or the county, or through the counties if they don't have a watershed district. I'm just getting at the most fair way to tax, to maintain the benefit for everyone.
And just bear with me, Representative Hansen. I'm going to gavel us in, and we're official now. And understand you had an amendment as well. I didn't.
Yep. I would.
First, we haven't moved the bill.
You have moved the bill?
No.
Okay. I'd move House File 2894 to pass
to the bill,
and then I would move the DE2 amendment.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
we've been notified, thank you, there is one technical change on line 1.11 where it's the second letter B should be letter A, so it should be notwithstanding paragraph A. So it would just be, if Representative Hansen could make that change, it would be greatly appreciated.
I'm sorry, we're talking about the bill?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, on the amendment on 1.11, the second B that's in parentheses should actually be an A.
And I would, okay. Mr. Chair, I would incorporate that into the amendment.
Okay. With that incorporated, all in favor of the DE2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. And to the bill now.
Mr. Chair, and I think you've had testimony on the bill. With the amendment, we've worked out, I think, some of the concerns that are there, and I fully support the bill and encourage its, as amended, and encourage its adoption.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize we already put the DE2 on, but if I could ask Representative Hansen, I'm trying to understand real quick, probably easier just to ask you, in the logic behind the amendment.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, I think if you looked at the sheet that I think is in our packet, there are some watershed districts, if we raise the borrowing or their ability to borrow, they'll never have the capacity, the tax capacity, to cover the note.
Oh.
So we're putting a floor on so that those itty-bitty or small watershed districts that wouldn't have the capacity wouldn't have that authority to go to that high of a level.
Any further comments or questions from members? Anybody in the audience that wanted to testify for or against the bill? Representative Marquardt or Representative Hansen would renew the motion that HF 2894 be passed, returned to Finance Committee as amended.
Mr. Chair, I think it has to go back to taxes. Or where does it ultimately has to wind up in taxes, I believe, Mr. Chair.
They're advising me that we send it to finance, and
okay.
That'll be the pathway.
Very good. Very good. Thank you.
So with that agreed to, all in favor of the bill, say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And Representative Gardner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If someone could move.
Mr. Chair. I would move Senate File 1323.
Senate File 1323.
And then, Mr. Chair, I have an amendment which would create eventually the third unofficial engrossment. This is a little more complicated, but someone could move that.
So I would
the A9 amendment.
I would move the A9 amendment to Senate File 1323.
We have the A9 amendment in front of us. Does everybody have that? Any questions on that? Did you need to speak to that at all? I'm looking at the.
Mr. Chair, that'll just put the file in the shape I'd like, and then we can just work off of that for discussion. So.
Very good. Okay. All in favor of the A9 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Amendment adopted. Okay, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate File 1323 is a bill that deals with needle stick injuries for hospitality workers and waste industry workers. It actually is something that impacts workers' comp costs considerably in some industries, particularly in airlines, garbage haulers, and some folks in the hospitality industry. Because I always seem to end up dealing with stuff that people don't want anymore, whether it's sewage or recycling or syringes, I was working with stakeholders on this issue. There have been efforts over the years to try and get different stakeholders together to try and figure out how to avoid having home users of syringes and lancets and other types of so-called sharps to keep those out of the garbage because they tend to pose a hazard to sanitation workers and also people in places like hotels, casinos, restaurants, and also airplanes. People have often left syringes in those pockets in front of your knees. And people can get stuck with needles that way. The risks are real. Hepatitis B and C actually have the opportunity to stay virulent for either a short time or even up to a week at room temperature. So those are the major hazards that we're talking about, not to mention other different types of infectious disease. After going through this bill in a couple of iterations and trying to figure out the best way to really encourage manufacturers of pharmaceuticals that are injected into us as well as the syringe manufacturers, I think we have some general consensus that this is an amendment that all the stakeholders can work with. We're We're really just asking the pharmaceutical companies who make the injectable medications and the syringe manufacturers to post on their websites information about how they're helping consumers find ways to safely dispose of this material. Previous language about having a container that you'd be required to get at a pharmacy has been dropped. Language about filing a plan with the pollution control agency has been dropped. So actually that was the reason it was before this committee, because there might be a fiscal note. That's really out of there. I think it would be just as effective to have the manufacturers have it on their website. That in turn is helping spur broader discussion about how we can resolve this issue more generally. This has been a lot more complicated than other bills that I've worked on with waste products because of the nature of the product and various incendiary conflicting federal and state regulations. So that's the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I should say that the folks I've been working with include some of the waste haulers, the pharmaceutical industry, the bioscience industry here in Minnesota, the syringe manufacturers, including one based here in St. Paul, and all of them are either in support or neutral. I haven't had anybody say that they're now opposed to the bill in its current form.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And once that Sharps container, if it's properly identified and everything else, once it's full, can that then be sent to the landfill, or does it need to go to a special place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton, to my knowledge, there isn't, I'd have to check, I want to say residential waste that's in that container isn't prohibited from disposal. I know healthcare facilities do have fairly rigorous protocols on how you have to dispose of these kinds of things, and so they're kind of covered. And even we here in the restrooms here now have Sharps containers for dropping off syringes. But the home use has really been the big issue. Ideally, you'd want to have that stuff taken to a place where there's an autoclave, where the infectious waste could be essentially sterilized, and then you could dispose of it safely in a municipal solid waste landfill or incinerator. That would be ideal. But in a compacting process on a modern garbage truck or a transfer station, or even at the landfill where a compacting tractor is used to crush anything in its path, what is usually a solid, rigid container will break, and all those Sharps will come out. So, and that's one reason a lot of waste workers are asked to get shots against things like hepatitis and to wear certain footwear. And Representative, that's sort of actually the big thing. Is, I mean, there is added cost by having to accept these in a separate stream for through a medical waste company, for example. And so that's where the hang-up is in trying to get some larger consensus on how to cover the cost for that.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, if you were a small employer, you know, landscaper, auto junkyard or something, and you only had a few employees, but maybe you hired a new employee and that person now was a diabetic and gave themselves shots a couple times a day, would the employer now have a way to contact somebody and get one of these boxes like we have in our restrooms now so they could have that at work? Or is that currently possible today? Or how do you deal
Mr.
with
Chair,
that?
Representative McNamara, there's nothing really stopping any employer from working with a vendor to have that material collected in a safe container. And there's some folks in the audience I could point you to. But there's nothing in the bill that would either require or not require that kind of a setup. But it certainly would be encouraged that anybody who might have home or business-generated Sharps to be able to collect that material. But again, there's nothing in the bill that has any mandates related to that. In fact, the bill would provide information for how that employer might be able to get in touch with somebody.
So if I was one of those employers and thought that I might have a reason to have this box, for lack of a better term, do I have to pay them for it, and then do I have to pay to bring that to the proper place to get
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, that would be correct. If it was free, we would have no problems here. We'd be collecting stuff till the cows come home. But that's the issue, is having a separate container and having it disposed of in a separate stream. That's where the cost is.
And my question is, would the employer then, if you had this employee, say you were a small three employees and now you hired a new employee and that person was a diabetic and gave themselves a shot once a day, could you tell the diabetic, well, put that in your pocket and bring it home? Because I don't want to get this box. It's going to cost me money. Or is that against the law to say you don't want the box? And if you get the box, you said it costs money, but do you have to pay for that, or does the manufacturer incur those costs and give you the box for free and tell you where to take it?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, there's nothing prohibiting an employer from saying to an employee, take it home. I mean, one thing a lot of people do now is they'll have a laundry bottle under their sink or something where they'll just store it because they don't want to stick themselves with it at home. You could certainly do that at an employer. There actually is one syringe manufacturer who has advocated for giving out a free container just so that you have something to put it in, but there would be no coverage of the cost. Whoever buys the box and chooses not to throw it away would be the one incurring cost for that.
So if you were this diabetic that gives themselves a few shots a day, when he buys the syringes or buys the product or whatever he buys from the manufacturer, do they give him or her some boxes where he could bring one to work if he wanted to? Or, I mean, do these boxes cost $10 or do they cost $1,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, I'd say they're in the, at least where the decimal point is, in the $10 category, but... I'm sorry, you're going to have to repeat the first part of your question there for a minute.
Well, I think this is a great idea to encourage it, and I'm just wondering, is there an economic disincentive for the employer to have one there? I don't want them to tell the employee to put it in their pocket and bring it home. I would think if it's a $10 box, I guess it's not a big deal. And then when you go to get rid of it, is it cheap to take it to the proper place?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, you know, one of the vendors in the audience could probably answer the question for what it really does cost, but I think a lot of employers would do a cost-benefit analysis and say the risk of one of my other employees or that employee being stuck with a needle with the potential for there being infectious waste, that cost is going to be a lot higher, and my workers' comp costs are going to go higher if I don't have a safe place to put these containers. So there's a cost either way. I would argue it would be cheaper to have a box and to work with a medical waste disposal company to figure out how to do that.
Representative Gunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gardner, I've been a diabetic for 19 years. I no longer use syringes. I got a pump. A lot of people are going to pumps, but the average diabetic spends $900,000 in their disease in their lifetime. They get tax deductions if they pay for it with cash because it's related to medical problems. If we're going to ask employers to provide something, are they going to get tax deductions from it? I suppose they're going to get something they're buying for their business. But when you look at, when it's all said and done, it's the person that's using that needle, that syringe, is the one that's responsible. It's not always easy to find, to go to a drugstore and get rid of your little 25 needles that you can put in your portable pocket you have in your coat pocket. So how are we going to stop people from going to shortcut, walking over there and just going and making sure the caps are, you know, I remember feeling guilty looking around and shoving that thing in there real tight so it doesn't come off. But I also remember picking up my garbage bag and getting that needle right in my hand and having to go across. So I certainly understand what you're trying to do, but mandating employers to do it isn't the answer, because they're still not going to get that needle put in the proper waste. How are you going to get people to be responsible enough to do that? Put a fine if you don't do that diabetic, we're going to cut your insulin off?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, just a reminder, the bill as amended has no mandates placed on employers. All it does is say the manufacturers and the pharmaceutical companies who make the injectable medication just have to post information on how you can take personal responsibility for those sharps. You bring up a broader question about how to address it. There have been some national attempts at product stewardship dialogues for how to get everybody who's involved to get it to get in discussion. One reason we're here so late on this bill is because my efforts to try and get some consensus at a state level have run all sorts of crazy mazes, and we haven't gotten there. And I think what you see here is about the minimum that is worth doing right now. And I think it actually is spurring, from the stakeholders I talked to, a broader dialogue and how we can all work together to try and help people do the right thing at the most minimal cost possible. I should point out, too, that the most of the medications and the syringes themselves are covered by things like Medicare, Medicaid, but the disposal of the sharps is not. And so there's some discussion about whether Medicaid and Medicare should be covering that, and that's a whole another ball of wax. But I think this is, again, the basic minimum of just getting the information out to the people on what they can do. There's a lot of people that say that's not enough. I agree. But I'd like to be able to leave this session and say we moved in the right direction somewhere and began a dialogue for a broader discussion later. And I'd love to work with you on that, Representative Gunther.
I would be very open to that, Mr. Chairman, very open to working with you. And I know there's 30 million diabetics in the United States alone. If they take three shots a day, that's 90 million shots a day, 90 million syringes a day. And then we got to get rid of them so the drug addicts don't get them. There's a lot of complications in the whole process. I applaud you for coming up with this issue. I think it's way, way overdue. But maybe we could figure the manufacturer come up with a disposable needle that will not last forever in the waste room. Air injection. Great idea.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really want to prolong the discussion of things that aren't in Representative Gardner's bill, but we did have a brief discussion about employment law, and I think it's important to be clear that the bill doesn't have anything to do with mandates on employers. But the question that Representative McNamara that you were asking about what an employer's responsibilities are and what you can lawfully ask an employee to do in terms of carrying those things home, that is an employment law question, and you would want to talk to an attorney before you asked an employee to bring sharps home, because there's a possibility that as an employer you have to provide a reasonable accommodation for that disability. So that's a separate legal question, doesn't really have anything to do with the bill, but I didn't want to create the impression from what we're talking about here that an employer can say to a diabetic employee you have to bring the needles home, because that's kind of a fact specific case. It would depend on the employer and how afflicted the employee was, and again, it's not an issue that's in this bill, but I didn't want to create a false impression with our conversation either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I maybe Representative Gunther can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that if a medical practitioner prescribes insulin, that you could take your sharps to your medical practitioner, who would have a way to dispose of these as they do in hospitals and doctor's offices. So I'm just kind of assuming that people who use the sharps at home could collect them and take them at their next doctor's visit. And maybe that's part of this education pattern that you've got in the bill. But that would appear to me to be the best way for a person to take care of their own personal responsibility. And you might want to correct me if I'm wrong, but that would be my observation.
That's a very good idea and a good way to get rid of them. You only have to see your little girl get that needle jabbed in her leg, carrying the garbage out once before you start looking for something to do. And there's a lot of sharps disposal units in bathrooms and public bathrooms. And they're getting more cognizant of that. There's so many diabetic people accommodating.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner, I just wanted to get some clarification. I'm looking at the amendment that you had on here, and I'm looking at line 118 and 119, and I'm not sure. It says it shall include at a minimum a description of the actions taken, if any, by the manufacturer. Well, does that mean that the manufacturer has to do 1, 2, and 3, or if they do 1, 2, and 3, they just need to post it? I guess I wasn't clear on that. Can you clarify for me, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the purpose of that sentence is to say you have to describe what you're doing for 1, 2, 3. But the if any means if you're not doing anything, you still need to say at a minimum that you're not doing anything.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from Members?
Mr. Chair, since there has been no fiscal note that I'm aware of from the PCA, and since I got rid of the language that may have incurred that, I don't even know that the bill now needs to be here so we can act and move it on to finance. So.
I'd just offer if there's anybody in the audience that wanted to give any testimony on this for or against. Seeing none, Representative Scalzi.
Thorough watch.
Renews your motion that Senate File 1323 be passed and returned to the Finance Committee as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Bill's passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. After careful study of the minutes of April 13th, I move approval of the minutes.
We have a motion to approve the minutes of April 13th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Next on the agenda, we have a presentation from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency regarding water quality enforcement. Galen Reitz, Shannon Lothammer, both of whom are here. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Please introduce yourself into the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Galen Reitz. I'm the director of the regional division, and I'm here to provide you an overview of enforcement as it relates to total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs. I think as you all know, the states are required to develop TMDLs for waters that have been identified as impaired and not meeting water quality standards, and the TMDL is the allocation of the reduction of pollutants necessary to achieve water quality standards. Before I get directly to the specific role of enforcement, I wanted to provide you just a little bit of context relative to some of the contributions to TMDLs that we found in TMDLs from various pollutant sources. What I have is data from some urban projects and some rural TMDL projects that have been approved by EPA. Obviously, each TMDL that we do is unique, since the water body, the different combinations of impairments and pollutants are specific to each of those water bodies. But what we're providing today is just a summarized view of the data, just for illustrative purposes, so you have some context for what we're finding in some of the TMDLs. The first pie chart that's up there is from a TMDL, or actually from a couple of TMDLs, where it's low dissolved oxygen is the impairment from an urban area. In this case, we found that 85% of the pollutant sources come from wastewater and stormwater, and that about 12% is an agricultural contribution. The second pie chart, and again, these are both urban examples, the second pie chart is for phosphorus and chloride impairments in an urban area, and about 60% of the contributed source was stormwater, and 35% of the pollutants were from internal loading from previous stormwater contributions. Next, let me just quickly give you three examples from rural TMDLs. The first two are fecal coliform bacteria impairments. The first one, about 75%, is from agricultural runoff. The predominant source here would be manure applied to fields as the source of the bacteria, and 25% from direct feedlot runoff and less than 5% from other kinds of sources. The second was a smaller watershed situation. This is a summarization of seven different projects, but you can conclude from this about 70% was from agricultural runoff, again, primary contribution from manure waste applied to fields, and about 20% from direct runoff from feedlots, and 10% from subsurface wastewater treatment systems, SSTS, contributions. The third and last chart from a rural example is a turbidity example. About 40% is from row crop agriculture sediment sources, 5% from urban stormwater, and about 55% actually from in-stream hydrologic processes. So these are just illustrative, but give you a sense of what are some of the major sources of pollutants that we're finding in the TMDLs. Now, once we've identified what the sources are, the loads are allocated from the various sources as far as what kind of reductions need to be made to, again, get back to water quality standards, and then we move forward with the TMDL implementation. So this comes back to where we were a week ago with the connection to the enforcement activities within the water quality program and how that relates to TMDLs. First, I want to just highlight that the PCA's regulatory authorities do not change as a result of TMDLs specifically. It's illegal to pollute waters of the state whether there's a TMDL in place or not. However, once a TMDL is completed, it may change the requirements that apply to a regulated activity. So, for example, within 1 year of a TMDL being completed and approved by EPA, it's expected that the permit will be revised to reflect the reductions necessary to achieve the TMDL. So if you go to the chart that's presented here, for those main sources that I talked about, wastewater treatment, stormwater discharges, feedlots, subsurface treatment systems, the permit requirements may change as a result of the TMDL. And as we move forward with that, for example, with the wastewater treatment system, the effluent limits within their NPDES permit may change, and then there may be requirements that to achieve those new effluent limits that they would have to do, which if it includes like construction, then we may add a compliance schedule gets added to the permit and defines the time that they have to make those changes. For stormwater discharges, the NPDES permit may require or may identify specific best management practices for construction stormwater, industrial stormwater, or municipal separate systems. In the case of feedlots, where to have an NPDES permit, it's assumed that there's no discharge from the facility, but there may be requirements, additional requirements in manure management plans, how they apply the waste to fields, and then we also provide specific support to county feedlot programs for the smaller facilities that don't have permits directly from us. And then finally, for subsurface treatment systems, we work closely with local and regional efforts, prioritize the resources that are directed to unsewered areas, and prioritize our financial assistance to these areas where there are TMDLs in place. So the point is, once a permit is changed, that becomes the enforceable document, and it is managed through our ongoing compliance and enforcement activities that you heard us go into more detail last week. These are the primary enforcement tools that we talked about at that time. And specifically for water quality, the outputs, using 2009 as an example, we had 252 specific enforcement actions related to wastewater. We had about 96 related to feedlots, 107 for SSTS, and 129 related to stormwater, of which the penalties related to these added up to just under $1 million. So I think that's the connection between TMDLs and enforcement. TMDLs don't directly require enforcement, although once a permit is in place, then the permit holder is expected to be in compliance with that permit. It just goes back to our normal compliance and enforcement follow-through.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've told us what you can do. When we have a TMDL on a particular body of water, you've done these things. What's the timeline when you expect that water body to move off the TMDL list? What are your outcomes? What do we have a schedule, and when we know the outcomes, Minnesotans will know the outcomes?
Mr. Beach.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, it's again going to be unique to each of the different water bodies that we're talking about, depending on the type of pollutants, how much is going in directly, how much may be internal loading. So it's a complicated question. However, what I can say is that in some cases, the compliance timelines, usually where it's a permitted activity, the expectation is that within two permit cycles, if they, for example, if a wastewater treatment plant that has to add additional infrastructure, they need time to design, plan, and build that infrastructure, put that in place. It may be up to 10 years before that gets in place. In that situation, though, the water body may respond fairly quickly, because once it's in place, it results in a fairly immediate reduction. Whereas a water body such as a lake that's had years of pollutants going into it, you can remove the sources going in, but there'll be some internal loading that it'll take some time to respond. So it can vary between very quickly 5 years to 10 or more. I think, you know, we need to keep in mind that response time of these natural systems is, you know, they didn't become degraded overnight, and there is somewhat of a lag time, although it can be fairly quickly. So it's very unique and individual.
I understand unique and individual, and I understand lag times. What I'm trying to get at is, for a specific one that you've done a TMDL on, can you tell the public that if we get these things done within this many years, we will get off the TMDL list? So that there is a, and I know they're going to be different, it is just the question of not, we've been so engaged in process for so many years, getting to an outcome.
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, yes, I think that I think in many cases we'll be able to describe, you know, what our expectations, if these things happen in this time, that we would have confidence it'll happen in this time. I can't, you know, put a specific timeline on it right now, but yes.
Okay, so if I can follow. So for so when we see a TMDL, or when the public sees a TMDL on their own water body, you can say, as part of that TMDL, if these things happened on a reasonable schedule, then by this time, our water body will be in better shape, or get off the TMDL list.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, yes, I think with some range, yes, I do believe we will be able to do that.
Okay. And final question. And is that right now part of your process, so people do know what the outcomes are going to be?
Mr. Reese.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, we do set clear goals, identify what the desired outcomes are to be. At this point, I don't think we have really gone to including time estimates, but it's something we can certainly consider.
I think that's important, since we're spending all this money and people are expecting outcomes, and of course then this money is coming to you with the expectation, because of the statute, of measurable outcomes, analyzing the outcomes, putting them on the website. So we need to have that for your TMDLs as well as for individual projects. I would see a TMDL as a project falling under that statute. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Van Dell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reitz, mining is a heavily regulated activity, as it should be. Can one assume that there is a connectedness between the granting of permits and the stipulations and conditions upon which a permit is granted to a project developer? Can the public assume that there's a connectedness between the granting of the permit, the conditions of the permit, and compliance on behalf of the project developer with regard to groundwater protection?
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I think many of our permits take that into account, and in fact, I think Ms. Lothammer is going to do a presentation related to groundwater and
thank you for that. So again, can the public be assured that when and if permits are granted, one of the conditions of granting those permits is that the permitting agency believes that the project is capable of being in compliance with the terms and conditions of the permit? And in cases where the permitting agency, in this case your agency, is not convinced that the science allows for the protection of water, that permits will not be granted?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, when we issue permits, we believe they are going to protect the resource.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And regarding the TMDLs and on the line of both Representative Anzeltz and Representative Wagenius, regarding measurable outcomes, I think that most of us legislators who worked on the Clean Water Act were very concerned about what's going to happen after this is passed by the voters, and it was passed by a wide margin. So we are protecting this money because it's the only money. It's the new money. And I think we have to be very careful how we spend it and how we and the outcomes that we get from it. So I guess my question would be to you, do you think that there might be developers out there or polluters who might be saying, I'm going to wait until the state comes and does a TMDL, and I know that what I'm doing might be wrong, but I'm just going to continue on my merry way until I'm forced to do something different? And then after we tell them what they have to do, do you think that there's people there just waiting for the second visit and the callback? Because this is what's going to eat up that money. And what is your impression of how that process is going to work rather than just put more and more money into a black hole?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think what we've seen so far is that when TMDLs are put in place, that people are working to meet them. And
those activities that we have regulatory authority over, I don't see that we've had a lot of specific enforcement actions because people are lagging behind on meeting the TMDL requirements. So I think that for the most part, it's we have over 90% compliance, as was presented last week, and I think it's fairly effective, and so I don't believe people are just waiting for in the area of the regulated activities.
And are we moving to Ms. Lenhammer, your presentation then?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lotthammer. I'm the manager of the water monitoring section at the Pollution Control Agency. And at the end of the hearing yesterday, there was interest expressed, I believe, by Representative Wagenius in hearing more about activities that the agency has going with groundwater protection. And so I'm here to provide an overview of those activities. So what I'll plan on doing is just providing a little bit of background about the Pollution Control Agency's role in groundwater protection, talk about our groundwater monitoring efforts, and then talk about the program activities and actions that we have underway and the strategies that we're employing to protect Minnesota's groundwater resources. So just a little bit of that background. At least 73% of Minnesotans rely on groundwater for their drinking water. So that's one reason why groundwater is such a critical resource for Minnesota. But that isn't the only reason why protecting groundwater is so important. Another example of the importance of our groundwater resource is that is the resource that provides the base flow for our rivers and streams that is so critical to our aquatic habitat. So providing that level of flow in the dry months to make sure that there's water there to support our fish and to support our macroinvertebrates and have a healthy community. Now with groundwater, because of the typically slow nature of groundwater movement and the recharge process, protection is very critical to maintaining that groundwater resource over time. Because once groundwater is polluted, it can be very difficult and costly to clean it up. And Minnesota has statutes that have been established and to create a multi-agency approach to groundwater management for the state. And in that process, agencies have been given specific authorities and responsibilities that focus on their strengths and expertise. And so collectively, the state agencies, together with local government and also with federal partners, provide the activities and the actions necessary to protect Minnesota's groundwater resource. In the case of the Pollution Control Agency, both the Groundwater Protection Act and the agency's enabling legislation specify the role for the PCA in groundwater protection. And our focus is on groundwater quality monitoring, focusing specifically on non-agricultural chemicals, and then also on preventing the release of pollutants from industrial and chemical types of activities, and then also detecting and cleaning up pollution when it does occur. And this next slide shows some information about the agency's groundwater monitoring activities. And those really fall into two main categories. The first is our ambient groundwater monitoring network, which is focused on monitoring for those non-agricultural chemicals in vulnerable aquifers. And the figure that you see on the right on the graph is actually the current network. And you may recall from earlier presentations and discussions about the Clean Water Fund and Clean Water Legacy Act that the agency is actually in the process of enhancing our ambient groundwater network with funds that have been appropriated from the Clean Water Fund in order to better be able to characterize the status of our groundwater in the shallow aquifers and how that varies with different land use types. So with that ambient network, we're looking at things like the presence and extent of contaminants in our groundwater, at trends over time, and then also at how our groundwater quality is changing. And we're focusing on that vulnerable layer, that shallow aquifer, as kind of an early warning system for contaminants that might be entering our groundwater so that we can do something about that from a management standpoint before those contaminants get into the deeper groundwater sources that tend to be our drinking water sources. The second type of monitoring that we do is actually associated with contamination and cleanup site monitoring. So for that monitoring, it's focused on specific sites where a spill or a release or a contamination has occurred. So the purpose is to first identify the extent of that contamination, to evaluate the progress of cleanup activities, and then also to characterize any contaminant plumes and track how those plumes might be moving or changing over time. Now, both of these monitoring types are very important for providing information to help us prevent future problems. So to help us characterize our current quality and understand problems so that we can prevent them in the future. This next slide summarizes the many programs and activities that the Pollution Control Agency has in place to protect Minnesota's groundwater resources. And you'll see that this varies from things like our petroleum remediation program, where petroleum spills are cleaned up before they can migrate into our groundwater resources or to prevent any further migration. Superfund cleanup sites where the same thing is occurring to address those contaminants to keep them out of our drinking water sources. And then also things like our hazardous waste compliance and enforcement, which you heard more about last week, where we have compliance and enforcement and permitting activities in place in order to prevent the release of contaminants in the first place and protect our groundwater resources. One key point to note about our cleanup programs is that, as you see on the right-hand side with the level of activity, the number of open sites have actually been decreasing over time, and that's a combination of addressing those problem sites that occurred historically and getting those cleaned up and stabilized, but then also preventing new ones from occurring. So the rate of new sites that are being identified is actually going down. That's one of the outcomes that we're very, very happy about to see. And that's really a combination of the permitting and compliance and enforcement activities and also assistance activities with the regulated community to help them understand what options are there to prevent pollution from occurring in the first place. Also on this slide, you'll see program areas that you might not typically think of as groundwater protection programs. And one that I'll point out particularly is our stormwater program. That's typically thought of as managing surface waters to prevent stormwater impacts on lakes and streams and wetlands. But it also is an important part of protecting groundwater, because one of the things that we do is when we're looking at managing surface water resources through doing things like infiltration basins, we also want to make sure that those practices are protective of the underlying groundwater resources as well. So we have guidelines and best management practices and guidance in place in order to both protect the groundwater and also help to manage the surface water. These next slides will actually provide just a few examples of the monitoring data that we have from our ambient monitoring efforts and highlight some of the strategies and actions that we have in place and some of the outcomes that we're seeing in addressing pollutants that may be finding their way into our surface water or into our groundwater resources and preventing any further pollution or addressing that pollution heading into the future. So this first slide actually shows chloride concentrations in shallow groundwater under various different types of land use, ranging from kind of background undeveloped land to land uses in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. And as you can see, we're seeing higher chloride concentrations in shallow groundwater in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and that's associated with things like the use of road salt and that migration that can happen into the shallow groundwater. Some of the wastewater treatment procedures can add additional chloride into our water resources, and as that recharges the groundwater, we see elevations in the groundwater quality or groundwater chloride concentrations. So things that we have in place to help address that is our permitting and compliance and enforcement efforts. We also have completed a total maximum daily load study for the Shingle Creek system in the metropolitan area, which again is focused on surface water resources, but there's definitely a groundwater component of that because especially during those dry months when groundwater feeds into our lakes and streams, we want to make sure that that's not adding chloride into the system. Yes.
Representative Wagenius has a question.
Yes, thank you. This is just a point in time. Do you have trends for this? I mean, it doesn't tell us much mm-hmm. about outcomes if we're just seeing a shot in time. Yes.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, that's absolutely true. Having that trend information is very helpful. And that is one thing that we're working towards with the enhancement of the ambient network. We only have data starting from 2004 when that network was restarted. So this is data from 2004 through 2008. It's not quite enough to be able to show trends yet, but we're very excited to be able to see that heading into the future because that will be very helpful.
But before you stopped monitoring and started monitoring again, you did have data, more historic data.
Do you have comparisons of the historic data with this data?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, that unfortunately that historic data had a different monitoring design. It was more of a baseline of all of the aquifers of the state, and then we did look at specific land use types, but it wasn't designed in the same way. It wasn't looking at that shallow aquifer and tracking that over time, so it's not comparable in a way that would allow us to really establish trends. We do bring in that historic data whenever we can to try to look at those trends and tease out what we can. But now we actually have a network that's designed to look at those trends in one fraction of the groundwater. So we'll have much better data going forward to allow us to do that.
It does seem to me that your outcomes division should be able to give us some indication of historic trends, and not for us to say, well, the year 2004 is the beginning of, because we did our groundwater work in 1989, so there's this big gap there. So I think it would be helpful for all of us to understand what we found out before and how it relates to the data we're coming up with now. Because this doesn't tell me anything. That doesn't tell me as much as I think we need to know.
If I may, let me reinforce that. I think there's information that would be valuable in that regard. I have a question, too, in regard to the It's the slide that's up there. The background. Do you know off the top of your head what that references?
Mr. Chair, I actually don't have the details of the land uses or where those sites there are with me today, but I can certainly give you that information. But my thinking would be that would be like undeveloped sites. So we do have monitoring well information from sites in Minnesota that are like open space, whether it's forested or restored prairies and things like that. But I can get you more details about that.
That would be interesting. And I think, and then following up on Representative Wagenius's question as well, with historical, because the next box whisker plot is forest, and that's what caught my eye. I'm looking at that number, and so I mean, up in our area in the north Minnesota, we think we have a lot of background. I know for many of the contaminants of concern in Minnesota, we're background. We're global background. Mm-hmm. And so when I see that background and then I see forest is significantly higher, if I'm reading that right, significantly higher, then that was my, that's what caught my eye. So more information, please.
Sir, I'd be happy to do that. Thank you. So this next slide actually looks at our nitrate monitoring results. And again, this is just the 2004 to 2008 data. Now, in the case of nitrate, we do have additional historical information that we've provided in previous reports, and I can certainly provide a reference to that report or send a copy to the committee so that you have that. Because I recognize that having that trend information is critically important to understand what's happening with our resources and to be able to manage them appropriately for protection. The strategies and actions that are a part of our nitrate monitoring are, again, things like the permitting and compliance activities that happen with our wastewater, our SSTS, our feedlot programs. Galen had mentioned earlier the work that we do with feedlot manure management plans. So when feedlot wastes are applied to land, the management plans are put in place in order to prevent the migration of nitrate from that land application, both to surface water but also to groundwater. So that's one example of the strategies that are in place to help manage nitrate and prevent nitrate contamination of our groundwater resources. Okay. We also have... Oh, yes.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Reitz, on the nitrate monitoring, I have a little memory on this going back to the Groundwater Protection Act of 89, and then even prior to that in 87 we had wells up there, and so we should have 25 years of data. Is that overall probably for on some of these wells?
You probably know that.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, we do have historic data on nitrate, and I can provide that information to the committee. I do want to note that with groundwater, sometimes trends can be very challenging because you're not just talking about a homogeneous amount of water. You know, the groundwater is fractionated into the layers and separated by the geology. So if you don't have data, you know, if you have data from one layer and data from another layer, they're not necessarily comparable to look at trends. And that's one of the challenges that we have in managing groundwater compared to, like, managing surface water, where you can kind of assume that it's a mixed layer and that it's homogeneous, and you need to look at kind of that resource over time. With groundwater, you've got that dimension added in. But that's not to say that we don't have data that we can look at, and we can definitely do that.
Jim Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, the data here, that, and maybe you went over this earlier, is just Pollution Control Agency data. It's not Minnesota Department of Agriculture data or USGS data or any other monitoring data.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, yes, that is correct. We do share data with those other agencies, and we also have graphics that show that information. But given that the focus of this presentation was PCA activities, we kept it to the PCA monitoring results for this slide. But we certainly have that information as well.
And one follow-up.
Representative Hansen.
And prior, I think it was LIMIC, the Land Management Information System. Mm-hmm. Now that's become MinGeo. So data collected from all of these sources does go to MinGeo, and so it's available for the public to view. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, actually, there's a little bit of a difference to that because in the time that the Land Management Information System and then MinGeo was created, there was also the statewide water quality database called STORAT that EPA supports, and that the PCA, as kind of the delegated authority for the Clean Water Act, was in charge of kind of maintaining. And so actually all of that data is going into STORAT as opposed to into a separate system, because there actually isn't another place to put it. But we're working with all of the agencies to get that data into one place so that it's available.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you. While we are looking at what PCA is doing specifically, PCA also should be the integrator of data. And so with regard to nitrates, I think it would be helpful for this committee and the legislature and the public to have that piece of integrated data with all of nitrates from 89 or 87, so we can see the trend lines, because this is, again, doesn't give us any perspective, really. It's just, again, a shot in time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would be good to see that data so we can see how we are doing as a state. And if you'd provide that to the committee, we'll get it around and we'll share it with other committees that would be interested. Outdoor and cultural would be interested, and I'm sure that ag would be interested.
Just, if I may just follow up too, that in the discussion of nitrates, it seems to me that the monitoring system historically would have been set up so that you were getting water from monitoring wells that were screened at a certain depth, and this was consistency in that, and there at least would be a valid screening tool using that well over time. That is that the correct assumption?
Mr. Chair, yes, they're definitely monitoring result, or the results from the monitoring wells are definitely valid, and they were good monitoring wells that were used. Because the different study designs had different purposes, they may have been at different depths. But if it would be helpful, I think one thing that we could do is maybe provide to the committee just a brief history of the PCA's groundwater monitoring activities that lays out kind of what parts of the groundwater we have historically monitored, and then also provide that information that shows the nitrate data that doesn't just include PCA monitored wells, but the information from other agencies as well.
If there was not a consistency over time with screened well depths, if we were putting in different wells, then I think that's something that's a problem. For sure, as far as trend analysis, I would question why anybody would even offer to do that. Let's get that information. And I think, I mean, well by well, that's what I would offer is give us the well information, and let's try and tease that out where we do have good screening data then. Trend data. Representative Guinness.
Yes, we were just given a report, and I think maybe we had it in our packets. I don't have it in my packet, of your outcomes for air and water. We got a pretty in-depth trend lines on air, but not on water. And given the amount of money we're sinking into water right now, I think we need to have that same kind of work, the big picture work, so we can see what's going on. Are we making a difference? Can Minnesotans see that they're getting outcomes? So it would be very helpful to have that integrated stuff. And so we can actually see what's going on.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, that is definitely something that we are looking to provide. The challenge with water is, you know, those resources were provided kind of starting in 2006, 2007. So it will take a little bit of time to be able to build that data set, but that is exactly what we're looking to try to do.
I understand that going forward, but we need to see where we were going back to, because you can't 2004 is not our base year. 1989 is our base year, if we're going to have any base year. So we need to go back and see what's been going over that time.
This is prompting another. I'm just thinking here, having done, I don't want to say how many nitrate analysis over the years for well users, but there were. Do you coordinate with the Department of Health at all? And I mean, they do these nitrate analyses? Is there a coordination, and we can bring data together that they may have that would offer trend analysis?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do coordinate with all of the agencies that are doing any kind of groundwater monitoring, and look for opportunities to combine that data to be able to tell the trend story.
And could you bring that to bear with information?
Certainly, yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know how many different groups and agencies are duplicating this work. It sounds like there's a tremendous amount of work and data that's being collected, how much money is spent, and if we'd have better outcomes if consolidation did take place and had one agency focus on this work. I'd like to see that information, Mr. Chair.
Well, I would offer to you, Representative Hamilton, I'd like to see it too.
And Mr. Chair, we can certainly, when we provide the information to the committee, lay out the PCA's responsibility and how that compares to the other work that the other agencies are doing, because we really do work hard to focus on our specific authorities and areas and actually avoid any overlap. So, but we can provide that in that follow-up.
Representative Guinness.
But let's go back and you are the agency that is in charge of groundwater. You are the ones that have the groundwater rules. And I know that for quality, and I think if we need to visit the statutes and rules and have a discussion about that, that may be something we need to do too. But that is your charge.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, the Groundwater Protection Act really does specify a multi-agency approach, and it doesn't indicate that one agency has kind of overall responsibility. The Pollution Control Agency shares responsibility for groundwater quality with the Department of Agriculture, with the Pollution Control Agency focusing on non-agricultural contaminants and the Department of Agriculture focusing on agricultural contaminants. So we work very closely together to make sure that we're doing that in a cooperative and collaborative manner, but the Act does lay out very specific authorities for each of the agencies.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a little visit with council on that, because the non-degradation rules are in your statutes. or in your rules, the non-degradation of groundwater. And we haven't met that. And so that's where we've got to come back to. I mean, that's the overall outcome, what's in your rules. So we'll visit more about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was just asking for that clarification as well, as if there is one agency that is in charge of groundwater. But I think you addressed that. So, thank you.
Representative Hens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think where the challenge comes is on in this slide, on nitrate. Unless you're tagging the nitrate somehow, you can't tell where it, whether it came from a feedlot or whether it came from lawn fertilizer or whether it from lightning or you have different agencies looking at nitrate and the sources. And the idea behind that is that there's different sources that ultimately will need different management. But with the ubiquitousness or the, that's probably not a word, it's probably too early in the morning for that. But, but the variety of sources for nitrate and impacting groundwater or the chemical reaction with nitrate that's there, that's the challenge. We deal with the trying to administratively manage it with different agencies, but when it shows up in water, it could come from a variety of places. And we've tried to have, and it's a 20-year try. I mean, we're at 21 years after the Groundwater Protection Act has come. So how do we, is what we've done working? When we look at chloride, that more clearly falls into your camp. If we look at a pesticide, an herbicide, then that could more clearly fall into agriculture's camp. If we're dealing with over 10 parts per million on nitrate, nitrogen, and water, then I'm guessing the health department gets involved because of the methemoglobinemia issue. So that's what we set up 21 years ago. And I think these questions are good questions now in the new reality of funding and cost and challenges on what would work best and what have we learned. You know, and that's why I asked the question about monitoring, because we've been taking samples and you've got 20 years of experience of dealing with this. What could we do differently to maybe be more efficient and effective and try to hit these goals? And it's a huge question. But I think it's the question that we have to look at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention, I have a little bill that I didn't introduce early enough to move this year to create a legislative commission on water governance and policy, because I think what Representative Hamilton and a lot of us are talking about is this frustration we have as legislators of having this divided authority between like five different agencies, and we don't know specifically with regard to each one what they're charged with and whether it's effective that we have this divided responsibility. Because if any of you have ever worked in a group of five people and you're all responsible, that actually means nobody's responsible, because you all sometimes think somebody else will do that. And I don't know that we need a legislative commission. We could do something like the bipartisan small business caucus over the interim, but to really look in detail at the statutory authority, the language that we've passed here at the legislature and how we've set it up and whether that makes sense today, because a lot of these statutes were put in place 20, 30 years ago, and they might not make as much sense today as our agencies have evolved. But I think we should continue this conversation over the interim. And if we don't pull it off as an informal group, I hope maybe I could get some bipartisan support for having a legislative commission so that we're more well-versed on it, so that we can do the reform that we need to if there's reform that we should do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you to an extent, Representative Hortman. I do think the Clean Water Council is in place and looks to a certain degree at things like this. Where one of the areas we do need clarification is in the relationship between the constitutional amendment that was passed that funds some clean water activities and the Clean Water Legacy Act that was passed in 2006. That relationship never has been real clear, and sorting out those responsibilities and how we approach this water issue is something that we do need to do. But water is everywhere.
And we're fighting, right?
I do believe we've reached consensus.
Well, with that, then maybe I'll move on to the next
Please
slide.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this next slide then actually focuses on our groundwater monitoring results for volatile organic compounds. Now that is an it tends to be an industrial pollutant that is pretty squarely in the Pollution Control Agency's arena as a non-agricultural chemical that we monitor for both in the ambient environment and then also as a part of our cleanup efforts associated with various contamination sites. And the graph that you see, or the figure that you see on the left of the screen, just shows where we've had detections, low-level detections of VOCs in the ambient network. So these are sites that were selected to be representative of land uses as a whole, and they're not associated with any specific remediation or cleanup type of a site. You can see where they've been detected, and then the graphic on the right actually shows the detection rate. It is a low detection rate of 5.7%. We do want to see that as low as possible, and this gives you a little bit of information about where we've seen those in those monitoring wells since 2004. And then the next slide actually then shows you some of the strategies that we have in place and the work that we're doing to reduce that rate even further, to really prevent those VOCs from entering into our groundwater resources. So whether it's tank inspection work in order to make sure that our above ground and underground storage tanks aren't leaking and leaking those petroleum products or products with VOCs in them into the soil where they have the potential to intersect groundwater. It could be our hazardous waste inspection and compliance efforts. Could be prevention efforts, working with small businesses or other regulated entities to look for alternatives to chemicals that may be more at risk for release into the environment, or better containment efforts to further prevent the potential for those chemicals to be released. The graphic that you see here is actually showing you the decline in our petroleum tank release cleanup sites. So since 2008, you can see kind of that progressive decline in the number of sites that are coming into the cleanup program. And that's really the result of a combination of that permitting and compliance and enforcement, so ensuring that we have good practices in place to prevent the release in the first place. And then also I think credit should be given also to our regulated community and an increase in the awareness of the importance of having proper containment, using proper procedures to avoid spills from occurring so that we don't have cleanup problems and we don't have that threat to our environment occurring.
Quickly, can I ask you, you kind of spoke to this, but do you do the short list PAH plus the diesel and gas range organics? Is that the common parameters?
You know, I don't actually have the list of parameters with me, but we can get that with the follow-up information.
Please.
So then just in summary of the groundwater protection and restoration activities underway by the Pollution Control Agency, again, just to emphasize that prevention is the key. That is a key tenet of the Groundwater Protection Act and a goal that the PCA takes very seriously. It is important to enhance our available data and information so we have that trend information and the information that we need to be able to better manage and address any pollutants that might be or that might have the potential to get into our environments and to be able to manage those resources more actively. We have both permitting and compliance efforts, and for groundwater protection, that includes both our water program activities and our land program activities as well. Both of those have groundwater protection aspects of them. And then best management practices, where we don't have regulatory authority, but we're working with entities to prevent further or prevent releases of contaminants. And we're also getting more engaged with local land use authorities. And a good example of that is in our closed landfill program, where we're actually in the process of mapping out where we have contaminant plumes and then where we have groundwater areas of concern associated with those plumes, so we can meet with the local land authority, talk about what might be happening now and in the future from a planning and zoning standpoint in that area, really work to try to minimize any future potential for issues at those sites, as well as addressing the current issues at those sites. And then finally, we're always looking for opportunities to capitalize on maximizing both surface water and groundwater protection, whether it's through total maximum daily load projects that look at both the groundwater and the surface water component of a threat or a concern, watershed protection strategies where we're looking to maximize groundwater protection while we're also addressing surface water needs, or things like partnership efforts with the Department of Health with source water protection. The Pollution Control Agency contributes information and expertise into that process as well in order to be more protective of our groundwater. So with that, that kind of summarizes the overview, and I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Lauthammer and Mr. Reitz. And we do have a couple of final questions, I guess, if we're going to get out of here. But Representative Wiginia.
Just very quickly, the LCCMR, the lottery money, has had requests for proposals in groundwater. And your agency has not been active in applying for that money. DNR has been very active, and I just wonder why.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, we have had a few applications that we've put forward. Most recently, I was involved in an application for some additional monitoring. We've had some real mixed feedback on that, and so, you know, that's been one thing that we've been trying to get a better handle on as well is you know, what would make us for a successful project. I think right now we're very busy with implementing the Clean Water Fund dollars and ramping up our ambient monitoring network. And for this particular round, that was why we didn't put forward any proposals, is because we're really at capacity from a staffing standpoint to get that network in place and start realizing the potential of that additional information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, just to follow up on my earlier comment, the way I understand it, between the different boards and agencies and everything, there's like 16 different agencies that have some responsibility for water quality. And I just raised the question, maybe it's not one, but maybe it's three, maybe it's five, so that we can be better equipped to share the information and to have one focus on the goal at hand. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One quick thing. I did recognize one of the authors of the Groundwater Protection Act is in the audience. Len Price, I think, was one of the, when he was in the House, so 21 years ago.
Thank you. No further comments or questions. No further business before us today. We stand adjourned.